Tibeca,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles, and critical believers. RevLab. Welcome to today's episode. Hello, Laurien.
Hi.
Good to see you. And you took me on a walk today along the Thames. It's a beautiful day. We are lucky. We saw the HM Belfast, which is the big warship and is open as a museum today. And then on the other side of the Thames, we saw the city of London, the high-rise building, the famous buildings, and then the very old Tower of London. And then this most amazing view, the perhaps most iconic building, the Tower Bridge.
I think it's the most beautiful of all bridges.
Is it your
favourite? It's so stunning. I think it's incredible. And it still opens, do you know?
Well, it's
a suspension bridge, and like every once or twice a day, when there's a ship coming through that has, you know, is too big to fit under it, they open it, and the whole traffic has to stop.
Yeah, I was once on a boat when you're kind of on a boat trip with the, that was actually with the City Swiss Club. They have a ball on a boat every other year, and then when you are like on a kind of party boat, the bridge opens in front of you. Yeah, so it does that. So now we are here in a kind of little corner, some cobbled streets, some beautiful buildings, and these buildings have quite special names. We are just here in front of the Cardamom building, and it also has a Fennel apartment, and there is a sign that leads us to the Jasmine building. Where are we?
The names of these houses is explained because we are in the old neighborhood called Shat Thames, where all the docks and wharves and all the warehouses used to be. Well, they are still here, but they're not warehouses anymore, where all the whole trade from all around the world, from the colonies of the UK, came in here. And in this, what we are currently at, the Butler's Wharf, is the largest warehouse complex in the whole UK.
So back the cardamom, in the day. Fennel, jasmine exactly. tea and all that?
Yeah, so each warehouse had its own goods that was stored there. So that's why the buildings have these names. So in this building here was all the cardamom. And then across the street there was the sugar wharf. So that's where all the sugar cane was stored that came in from Jamaica and other places. And you have tea, you have cinnamon. You have all goods from around the world. You have the tobacco docks, etc. And I just found this really amazing because you can still see the history, not only by the names that are still in big letters on it, but as we are now walking around, we can see that, you know, these buildings have, they still look like big warehouses with you know, still cranes sort of attached to them outside that you can see. Obviously, they're not used anymore, but you can see that. You know, when you walk around the cobblestone streets and you see all these things, you can really sort of imagine or picture how you know, thousands of workers laborers would walk down and wheel like barrows down the street and haul it up to the next level, unload the ships and bring it all here. And I wanted to show you this place because I think it's not only fascinating to see the history, how you can still see it today, and how all the food and all the goods from around the world would come into London, but also because I live very close to here,
so I find this
a very fascinating
place.
Yes, I want to show you my neighbourhood.
By the way, we also have a third, maybe not person, but element with us today, that's the wind.
Oh, yes.
Is that like, it's the holy trinity of podcasts. But anyway, let's move a little bit more in this entrance over here. So hopefully it's not going to bother us too much. And there might be people coming out because we're now at these...
The Assam House.
Assam House.
Tea or something.
The residents of the Assam House might come out. And so it's all kind of incredibly modern, and these buildings are now... fancy lofts and expensive restaurants. We just walked past one. You said there was a
Michelin star
restaurant. This is completely different from a few decades ago.
It's become very gentrified.
Yeah, a few decades ago, this was really run down, poor area, wasn't it?
So it's really interesting to think of the history of it. So, as I said before, there's like 200 years ago, for the last 200 years, this would be the commercial hub of this city. But then, you know, as technology advanced, trade would change and ships would improve and become bigger. And then eventually, in the late 60s and in the 70s, the ships would be so big, you know, think of these modern container boats, that they couldn't come up the way up the Thames anymore, because the water was too shallow and the Thames would just become narrower. So further and further, so starting from here, where this is the furthest into the city that the ships would go, the docks and the wharves and the warehouses slowly started to close down.
Right. And I always thought it was because of aviation, but it seems it was much more complex than that. Yeah,
no, most trade is still today is done by huge container boats. That's still the case, and only the very few goods are transported by plane nowadays. But then, yeah, they would close down these docks and wharves in this time, and then all these docks would start to close, and that has also had huge social, as you mentioned earlier, and economic consequences for this area, because unlike today, all the houses of the dock workers and the labourers who would come here, these hundreds of people, were just behind us. So if you walk 2 minutes down the road, you can find these blocks that still exist today, which are huge estates with you know, loads and loads of very small apartments on many floors, where they would, you know, share, different families would share kitchens and bathrooms on the same floor, for example.
Incredibly
so cool. They all became unemployed when you know, the trade would stop and the ships wouldn't come all the way up here anymore. And that obviously led them having to leave. So many of those families had to leave and move somewhere else. Yeah, so in the 80s, the government had to think what to do, you know, with these huge and very centrally located buildings, because the city would expand and get bigger, but you need to do something with it. So they started a whole investment plan and turned all these warehouses and docks into flats and offices, and developed the whole area. So it's a really typical example of gentrification. I would say you can really see that, you know, at the beginning there were artists moving in when it was still very cheap to live here, and then when they started the development works, it would become much more expensive. And now if you walk around, you see this like amazing houses and flats around here, you know,
those flats,
these lofts with, you know, with like exposed beams, and you can see across the Thames onto the Tower of London or onto the city. So it's really beautiful and incredible to live here, but obviously very expensive as well.
Yeah. And to learn more about this history, there's this great museum, a new museum actually, by the Museum of London. They opened a few years ago a new museum, Museum of London Docklands, which is Canary Wharf. Mm-hmm. And Canary Wharf is a redeveloped area, which is like the second city of London, because the city of London became, there wasn't enough space for the new buildings and all the new office spaces that was needed. So the area Canary Wharf was redeveloped and is now a new kind of city of London. And there was this museum where you can learn a lot about the Docklands, history of the Docklands, and also the history of slavery.
Mm-hmm. That's obviously a huge part of the commercial, the trade around the world that came into here. It wouldn't be possible without thinking about the slaves that were involved in this as well. And it's interesting to think about the, you know, the dark sides of the, hope you can't hear, this is a labourer coming down with a wheelbarrow, just as we speak. we think about, you know, the dark sides of the global trade as it was, and maybe still is to some extent today. And it's rarely talked about, you know, slavery and colonialism, the impact that it had on the communities there, which I think is quite surprising.
Yeah? I find it really surprising how little it's talked about. And I remember when I first went to the Museum of Docklands, I was kind of surprised, because it was the first time I went to a museum where there was really quite a big area of the museum that talked about slavery. And I sometimes find in Britain that the difficult, as you say, the dark sides of British history, it's not very present, it's not very talked about. It's always this kind of great empire side of things that is much more talked
about. What I learned recently, what I also found really astonishing, that it's not even on the school curriculum. So it's not mandatory for for a kid going to school in the UK to learn about colonialism and slavery. Mm.
That's really
you can only learn about it if you choose history as a focus subject, but if you just, you know, follow the normal, you don't learn anything about it. And there's a group of students, activists, who try to change that and put it on the curriculum so that it's mandatory for everybody to learn about. Yeah,
but I think so it's a very different approach here in a way.
It is, but I think in Switzerland we could also do more and learn more about, you know, Switzerland's involvement in, or some of the darker sides in history, be it in the Second World War or also in the colonial business, because Switzerland didn't have any colonies but was still economically involved in the slave trade and colonialism itself.
And it just comes to my mind that is even true for church history in Switzerland,
right?
Because the Reformation history, and we just had these 500 years since the Reformation, well,
yes.
It refers to the beginnings in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and then recently was also a celebration for the Zwingli year.
Yes.
But it's very much on the positive sides and the positive developments of the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what happened in Zurich, the Anabaptists who tried to push the Reformation even further and deinstitutionalized church and moving away from authoritarian church structures, Zwingli had a very difficult approach to that.
Right.
And Anabaptists were killed. They were
drowned.
Zwingli drowned Anabaptists in the Limmat.
Wow.
And
I
it was only just
this.
Very recently that this that there has been a kind of an effort to look into this
mm-hmm.
side of the Reformation and also
mm-hmm.
Some commemorations for these events during
mm-hmm.
the Reformation in Switzerland. So this is
mm-hmm.
also very true for church history. There are always sides of...
Mm-hmm.
We always have to look at
mm-hmm.
history from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
And these blind spots are so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think education plays a huge role in this, of course. And then museums, you know, can teach a lot as well. As you said, the Museum of London, Docklands.
Oh, and another thing, of course,
yes.
if you don't travel to London very soon, there isn't...
even though we want you to come here, you don't have to.
There is a TV series. And actually, the Docklands feature in many films and TV series.
Mm-hmm.
But probably one of the most famous ones at the moment is called The Midwife. Some of
yes.
you might know.
Yes.
That plays in Poplar, which is a bit further east from here. It's actually
mm-hmm.
where I lived when I first moved to London.
Right.
I lived in Mile End, which is very close
to Poplar.
Yeah,
very east London, yes, yes.
And Called the Midwife is a TV series where you will learn a lot about kind of the historic backdrop of
mm-hmm.
of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And
you can also see about the economic and social conditions.
And the need for nurses. And, it's a history about a team of midwives who are called out to... give birth and look after the families.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting one. It's also easy to watch, but I think
mm-hmm.
it's historically quite accurate
mm-hmm.
and informative as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like it around here very much when I used to live here. When I first moved to London,
mm-hmm.
my now husband lived in Bethnal Green,
mm-hmm.
and then we lived together in Mile End
mm-hmm.
in a little shared flat, which is not far from the Thames, near Victoria Park.
Yes, I know the
and
area. Yes.
Yeah.
Because my girlfriend grew up there as well.
Oh, right.
So I've been there many times.
She's a real Londoner.
Yeah.
Yeah. My husband actually grew up in Bedfordshire, so he's... But he moved here.
But he lived
so
there for
a And now we moved to North London. I do still miss East London.
Mm-hmm.
Just the cultural diversity in the markets as well.
Mm.
We didn't really
yes,
talk about the markets
yet.
Yes,
that's one of the things I love about here
and
as well.
And it's all different. I mean, you have the kind of cloth markets, you have the food markets, flower markets. One of my favorite is the flower market in Columbia Road.
Mm-hmm.
Or kind of the Sunday markets.
Mm. Or an amazing one is Borough Market, which is very close to here. That's one of the things I like about being here. So I live in a... Sadly, not one of these lofts that I talked about, but one of these former estates nearby. Very small apartment, but I love that I'm so central that I can, in 5 minutes, I'm in Borough Market, which is a huge, beautiful market just by London Bridge, where you can find food and drink spices from all over the world. Whatever you think of eating, you can find it there. There's also fresh produce and
Swiss
lots of
cheese.
Spice and Swiss, yes. So
yeah.
there's a Swiss cheese stall as well. I used to get my raclette there. I remember.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, you know what? Talking about raclette and fondue, there is this thing with fondue. It's kind of coming back into fashion. Yes, yeah. I remember once my mother-in-law, she once said that fondue was very fashionable in Britain in the 70s.
I didn't know about that.
And I said, well, how do you mean fashionable? Fondue is not a thing. It's not a question of fashion.
Yeah, it wasn't ever fashionable in Switzerland. It's always.
Fondue is always
good.
And so apparently in Britain that was, there was a fondue wave in the 70s when people had their fondue sets and everything.
And here we're talking cheese fondue.
Cheese fondue, yes, right. We're talking cheese fondue, yeah. I would say probably the kind of Chinese hot pot I can imagine was probably always around here as well because of the trade relationships with China. And now the fondue, the Swiss cheese fondue is coming back. There are restaurants, not even just Swiss restaurants, but various restaurants in London who have it on their menu. And you can even buy the burners.
Oh, I saw
that. The gel burners.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
And that's very new. Mm. I mean, like 2 years ago, you couldn't find those anywhere. Mm. You had to go to the Swiss church.
Because you have loads.
We have a lot of fondue sets at the Swiss church because we can cater fondue, Swiss cheese fondue for up to 60 people. But the tricky bit was always the gel burners.
To find them.
We couldn't find them until recently. So someone had to get them from Switzerland if you wanted to do a fondue. And the thing is, you're not really allowed them in your hand luggage or in your hold luggage. And a lot of Swiss
people...
So you
had to smuggle it in.
They smuggle in their gel burners in the hold luggage, but you shouldn't have them, really. And now you can buy them. There is a nearer to where I live. There's a little kitchen shop and they have the gel burners.
So now it becomes much easier to live a Swiss lifestyle in London. Before you had to do illegal things in order to be properly... You know,
exactly.
Live your traditions here.
We're not illegal anymore.
Not illegal anymore. Well, who knows with Brexit?
Yeah, that's true. We'll go back.
Never know.
In the import of the gel paste from Switzerland, that might be one of the biggest issue in Brexit's negotiations, actually. Hopefully the government Mind the Gap strategy will look into this.
We need to tap on our contacts at the embassy to
make sure that
there's an exception for that.
Yeah, and you can buy Tommy Semp. It's actually, it's quite interesting because we're used to talking about food and the food import and all that. Yeah. The Swiss church used to run a big Christmas fair for many years, and one of the most popular events in the Swiss community. You could buy your Tommy Semp, your Swiss chocolate, and all these kind of things. And then when I first began my work as a vicar, I continued that Christmas fair, but it wasn't all that popular anymore. And it was a lot of work to get it going, but less and less people came. And the reason is, of course, you find these things now in shops. I mean, I think Sainsbury's has Tommy's Emph, I think.
Sainsbury's is one of the big supermarkets, for those who know.
Yeah. And then the other supermarket chain, Waitrose, they have fondue. You can now buy Emmy fondue at Waitrose. So I think it's just there was no need anymore for people to come to the Swiss church Christmas fair to buy these things. Yeah. And that was very different a few decades ago. So we stopped that Christmas fair, and obviously you can order everything online nowadays. Yeah.
But you still do the fondues.
We're still trying to do it. It became harder to run it because obviously it needs because our congregation is getting older and people who commit to run events. It's very easy. It's not very easy to find, and obviously, so we have to see how. Mm. Yeah, but we do still do our fondue evenings. I think also that's where we met.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. Could have been the first time, but I definitely, I've definitely been to fondue night at the Swiss church before. It's possible.
Times, yeah,
so many moons ago.
If you want to bring something from Switzerland to your Swiss friends here in London. Fondue gel paste.
Yeah, but
it's a good thing.
You might need to smuggle it, so beware.
Make sure it's not in your hand luggage.
We're not encouraging illegal things.
No, we don't encourage that.
You're self responsible for your.
We didn't say anything. Yeah, we didn't. Well.
Great. Let's go and.
Let's
check
go back
out.
To the Thames and enjoy the wind.
Go to Borough Market, find some proper Swiss cheese. There.
Yes, let's do that.
Let's do that. So, we come to the question to the vicar. A listener wanted to know from you, Carla, why does the church always get involved with politics? Doesn't it have more important things to do?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, it's a big question, churches and politics. Church and politics have always been very intertwined from the very beginning.
I mean, it kind of started with the Roman Empire adopting Christianity as the state religion. A few hundred years after the first communities obviously were a bit more kind of underground and resistant and all that. But from then on, it was really very much about, you know, who has the power, the church or the politics, and how much are they intertwined or not. And that was like, it came in, there were different stages throughout church history. But I think the at the very core, really, it's all about what role the church should play in society.
Right.
And I think there might be different people might have different answers to that.
What's your answer?
Well, I think it's actually fairly simple and straightforward, and something that probably all Christians would agree on is that the church's role in the world is to preach and live according to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the content of that gospel, well, again, okay, there you could probably come up with different answers, but for me, and it's very much the message, love your neighbor as you love yourself, and treat people the same way you want to be treated, which is called the golden rule, and also is one of the philosophies or theologies of many other religions as well.
But couldn't you just do that through charity as well, instead of getting involved in politics? You help the poor, you help homeless people, etc., without, you know, talking about the underlying causes, etc.
Well, yeah, I mean, churches in England are charities, so we act like a charity. But I think the question is the same for charities. When do you come political? And there, of course, you open the whole kind of question of what is politics. I think very often we think about party politics when we talk about politics, but really it's all about how we shape society and how we live together peacefully. And politics is how you put the rules into place that everyone follows, and what these rules are. That's really the big question, I guess. And so for charities and churches, the question is pretty much the same. How much do you get involved in that process of making laws and taking a stance on what's the right way to achieve those goals?
So if I understand you correctly, that means for you, living according to the gospel means shaping those rules and having a more political role in that as well as a church.
Well, I think we can't completely avoid it, and I think it wouldn't be right to completely avoid it. If you look at the gospel, and if we look at also Jesus acting in the world, and then at the same time we look at the big topics on our agenda nowadays, for instance the worldwide refugee crisis or the kind of migrant movements, what Jesus welcomed a stranger, that's one of the very one of his core messages is welcoming the stranger. And so we can't not have an opinion on people moving from one country to another, and our neighbors being from a different country, ourselves being from, and how we behave towards these people. And then, of course, you very quickly get into politics. Other topics as well, like poverty, which is a big topic in London, in the whole of England. I mean, the poverty in England is really quite outrageous for a rich country. For the rich country, it is the situation of homelessness. And how would Jesus treat, or how did Jesus treat people in that situation? And he was actually advocated for those at the margins of society, or for those in these situations. So then again, you come into kind of political fields if you want to, say something about it. It's not even just about talking about people. It's also about how we treat the planet, how we treat the creation. Religious terms, God's creation, and that's also another very big topic, and we can't just be quiet as church.
So if you don't take an active stance and advocate for people at the margins of society and the planet, then that wouldn't really be living according to the gospel.
Well, I would say so, yes, because it's also like, theologically, if you look at what Christianity actually means, or the place of God, or the relationship between God and people, is that God sent his son or her son into this world to be and live with us, to even die with us, and to act in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jesus talks about the kingdom of God, it's also about, it's always about mm-hmm. the kingdom of God is here and right now. It's not somewhere in the distant future, it's not somewhere else, it's here and now, and we have to build it now. And so I don't think it's an option to remain quiet. And also, at the same time, you know, being active and being outspoken about these topics that are at the same time topics from the gospel and at the same time political topics. And if you don't say anything, you're also political.
That's true, yeah. Silence is a message too.
Silence is a very strong message. Or not, like, for instance, not paying attention to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of my waste, for instance, or my kind of meat consumption, my lifestyle, in terms of, yeah, exactly. I could do much, much better, and I know I should.
Mm-hmm.
And not doing that is also political. I think these individual actions we take, or the change of lifestyle that many people now start to do, they are also political, and it's very important we do that.
And where do you draw the line? Do you, when you say you advocate for certain topics, does that mean in elections, in votations, you say what you would vote for? You try to bring a message across and get others to vote the same way? Or where do you draw the line?
I don't say that ever in sermons, because I don't think Sunday service is a place for that.
Right.
On Sundays, I preach the gospel, and as I said, when you preach the gospel, then sometimes, not always, the topics you preach or the texts that come up, of course, can be very closely related to current political affairs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're not, so it can be both. But I think it's important that we don't let what we preach on Sunday should be relevant for people's lives, but not necessarily always respond to current affair topics. Because people who sit in your congregation, they have all kind of struggles in their lives, and it's not always about that.
Right.
But it should always be relevant, and it should always be critical. But there can be in many different fields. But I do share my political views, and I do feel that they are closely linked with my Christian faith as well. But then my political opponents, who might have very different stance politically and are Christians as well, they say the same.
That's
the problem.
That makes
so,
it more
yeah, they just say they have kind of different... The one thing is what, like, the values... You might share the values with people, like the Christian values, these kind of basic message from the gospel. But then in real life, or how you implement that into law, really, and how you implement that on the political scale, you might have very different answers. And the problem is, like, then when it comes to these very practical opinions, you can't find the answer in the gospel. You just find the kind of the core ethical principle.
And how you translate that.
How you translate that into today.
Yeah, you've got a big range of opinion.
Yeah.
And my role is also to make sure that the whole question is answered. So there's a second part to the question is, doesn't church have some better things to do, more important things to do, other than being involved in politics?
And there I would say no, because this is exactly what the church should do. Preach and live in this world and build the kingdom of God in this world, in our communities and in our neighbourhoods. And that is political.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist Peter Yardley Jones.
Breath Lab.